Hey guys, the official OCDstories.com membership site is now live. You can find out more at theocdstories.com/join. Perks of membership include 2 extra bonus episodes a month, one with an OCD expert or maybe a monologue from myself. The other one will be a monthly roundup of behind the scenes of what's been going on with the show, things I learned from the episodes, and just generally in the world of OCD recovery. There will also be a weekly thought article, entry each month to win an OCD recovery book, suggest questions for the podcast, and of course, much, much more. So if that sounds of interest to you and you want more than the 4 interviews I already release each month, please head over to theocdstories.com/join. Hey guys, welcome to episode 116 of the OCDstories.com podcast. Now, back by popular demand is Dr. Fred Penzel. He was highly requested again for a second time by many of you, so I thought I'd take the opportunity to speak with him. I enjoyed my first conversation. He's a licensed psychologist. He's the executive director of Western Suffolk Psychological Services. He has many, many years of experience with treating OCD, BDD, trichotillomania, and PTSD using CBT. He was one of the founding members of the ISDF Foundation. And in this episode, I wanted to break down one of his articles, which was 25 Tips for Succeeding in Your OCD Treatment. One of my friends really liked this article, and it was a huge impact or at least starting point in his own recovery. So I wanted to pick out some of the things that Fred wrote in that and unpack it, such as always expect the unexpected. Remember that dealing with your symptoms is your responsibility alone. Also, how does a parent, friend, loved one handle reassurance seeking? Remember that in OCD, the problem is not anxiety, the problem is the compulsions. And then I asked Fred sort of 4 listener questions, the questions you guys submitted. And we also talk more in sort of tolerance of uncertainty, key things he notes in his clients that recover much quicker. Fred's a very knowledgeable guy. I enjoy this conversation with him. We get a bit philosophical at times. I reflect on my own sort of career in marketing, obviously transitioning now into mental health, but you know, I'm academically trained in marketing and sort of nearly a decade of actual practical experience. And it's kind of a disclaimer that I may sound negative to marketing this, and I'm not. I was more reflecting on my own career and the fact that the way I was doing marketing just didn't align my values. Like anything, marketing is a tool that can be used for good or bad. I like to think I use it for good now when I'm promoting this podcast. So yeah, disclaimer over. Enjoy this episode with Fred. I'm sure you'll get a lot out of it. On today's episode of the OCD Stories podcast, I have Dr. Fred Penzel. Fred is a licensed psychologist. He is the executive director of Western Suffolk Psychological Services. He specializes in CBT for OCD, BDD, trichotillomania, and PTSD. Fred is a founding member of the International OCD Foundation and author of the book Obsessive Compulsive Disorders, A Complete Guide to Getting Well and Staying Well. Welcome back to the show, Fred.
Thank you.
It's good to have you back on. You're a requested guest, so it's a privilege to get you back.
That's flattering.
No worries. So basically the first few questions is going to be from your article, 25 Tips for Succeeding in Your OCD Treatment. So this is a great article, and I believe you did one years ago. Was it 10 Tips? And one of my friends who has, I may have mentioned this the first time we spoke, but he has OCD, and when he was really struggling, he came across your article, and that really helped him. And he contacted you, and you pointed in the direction of someone here in the UK that could help him. So he still attributes you as a big part of his recovery. So
good.
Sorry if I said that before.
That's okay.
Cool.
Glad to have been a help to your friend. I'm happy to hear he's doing well.
Absolutely. Yeah. He's thriving. And so anyone listening, it's a good article, this one. So I'll put a link in the show notes. But the first question is, you put a point around always expect the unexpected, which I think is a great bit of advice. But my question is, how would one expect the unexpected?
Well, you know, what's the old saying? Forewarned is forearmed. So if you know that OCD can throw things at you unexpectedly, like new themes or new topics or new awarenesses, then you won't be caught off guard. You'll be able to say, okay, is something new, but I knew this could happen. This is nothing out of the ordinary. It happens all the time, really, to many people. So it doesn't mean that I've suddenly taken a turn for the worse, or that I can't be helped, or that nothing can be done, or it's always going to be, you know, terrible for me, you know, these kinds of things. Yeah. You don't fall into those kinds of traps, basically.
Okay. So, yeah, so absolutely. Expect the unexpected. Kind of be ready for it, I guess, that it could rear its head at any moment.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, because OCD can, you know, come up with new themes or new thoughts at a moment's notice, really, without any warning. It has this quality of being able to morph into all kinds of different shapes. One of my patients likes to say that it's OCD putting on another costume.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that one. Yeah, I always talk about it from it's putting on a new mask.
Yeah.
But it's the same creature behind that mask, effectively.
Yeah, it's the disorder of a thousand faces.
I've never heard that, but that, yeah, truly sums it up. Okay, so next question, the point in the article is, remember that dealing with your symptoms is your responsibility alone. So I guess, why is this, and why is it important to know it?
Okay, well, I think, first of all, you know, the best way, of course, to overcome any fear is to face it. And let's face it, no one can be a stand-in for us or do it in our place. It's our own brain chemistry, our own habits that we're trying to change here. And it takes place inside our own minds. So no one can do this for us. We have to do it ourselves. And it's the only way learning takes place, is through your own direct experience, basically. So I think that, you know, if you try to get other people to show you the way or give you reassurance or all these things, then you're not really learning. You're not doing it yourself. And this is the only way, really, to learn, is through your own, as I said, through your own direct experience, through facing things yourself. And it builds up your confidence, too. If you only do something because somebody else is encouraging you or assisting you, then you really can't take the credit for it. They get at least part, if not all, of the credit.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. Okay, so this is one of my questions. How does a parent, friend, or loved one handle reassurance-seeking behaviors?
Well, sometimes I will tell people, you know, right at the outset of therapy, not to seek reassurance from anyone. And, of course, the first responsibility, of course, is with the person themselves. Yeah. But if they find it hard at first to not, you know, because let's say they have a very strong habit of asking for reassurance. And, you know, as we know, habits don't just disappear. They have to be gradually diminished step by step. But I think that very often we bring in significant others and we tell them, okay, you know, the person may tell you, look, you're not helping me when you don't reassure me, or you don't answer my questions, or you don't do things for me. And we have to sort of help them get it clear in their own minds that by not answering questions and by not giving that kind of assistance with compulsions, that they actually are helping the person, and they do it because they care about that person and because they want to see them get better. That by doing these other things that they're not supposed to be doing, they're feeding into the problem. They're throwing fuel on the fire. And, you know, I say, look, would you buy alcohol for an alcoholic, or would you go out and score drugs for a drug addict?
Yeah.
None of these things would be very helpful. So we do, sometimes we have to be, you know, strict or tough because we care and because we know that ultimately it will be in the person's best interest. Now, they may not thank us for doing this at the present moment, but I think you have to take a certain amount of comfort in the fact that one day when that person is recovered, they'll understand why you did it, and they'll also accept it, and they may even thank you for it ultimately.
Yeah. Yeah, good idea. So it's kind of a bit of psychoeducation on behalf of the family member.
Absolutely. People can get very caught up in other people's compulsions. You know, sometimes they'll either do it to just quiet the person down, or they'll say, well, we don't want to make them anxious, or I can't stand to see them suffer like this, so if I can do something to help them, I will. Mm. You know, people come up with all kinds of rationalizations why they should be getting involved in symptoms. But the bottom line is that by involving themselves in it, they're only making the person worse and making them dependent.
Yeah. Yeah. Good advice. Okay. So then the next point in your article is you put, remember that in OCD, the problem is not the anxiety, the problem is the compulsions. I get this, but it'd be good to, I think it's a valid point, it'd be good to explain that for the listeners and why it is important.
Okay. Well, I think that many sufferers believe that the problem, of course, is the anxiety, which is why they do compulsions in the first place, because compulsions are designed to relieve the anxiety or to neutralize it and to make it go away. But of course, what they don't realize is that the compulsions themselves end up taking over the person's life and engulfing them, basically, and preventing them from functioning on a, you know, normal everyday basis. So consequently, if the person thinks that the anxiety is the problem, they're just going to do more compulsions. Mm. But if they realize that the compulsions are the problem and they resist those, now they're actually facing the anxiety and they're assuring themselves that the anxiety actually will diminish because they're building up their tolerance by staying with it and by not avoiding it. They're also learning the truth about what really happens when they don't avoid or don't do compulsion.
Mm. Yeah, okay. So when you're explaining this to one of your patients, do you do some psychoeducation around anxiety and around the actual feeling and emotion of it? And then do you also teach any kind of, I don't want to say coping skills, but ways of handling anxiety, whether that's breathing or anything like that?
Okay. Well, actually, we don't try to teach people to do things to diminish the anxiety other than by staying with it, because that's the ultimate lesson that we're trying to teach here, that breathing or other things like that can actually become new types of compulsions, actually. So the idea is to learn, I think, to accept that you can feel anxious. And the phrase that I often use with my patients is, I say, it's uncomfortable, but it's not dangerous. Mm. Okay, so you can... The idea that I can't stand to feel anxious is faulty. It's incorrect. People can stand to feel it. I try to explain to people that it's just adrenaline being released into your bloodstream, and this is what brings on the sensations of anxiety. And I tell people, if I were to give you an injection of adrenaline right now, you would get all the same symptoms of anxiety that you experience when you get an obsession, basically. So the idea is to... You know, as one of my patients said, like the light bulb went on over his head, and he said, I see now that if I just stay with what I don't like, it will cease to bother me after a while, but I just have to stay with it. And I think that's, you know, one of the biggest lessons that we have to teach in OCD treatment is exactly how to do that. So, you know, again, there's no escape from what we fear, because it's an internal event. So the idea here is to stay with what you fear long enough, and as I said earlier, to learn the truth about what really happens when you stay put, when you don't run away, when you don't turn off whatever it is. And you see that you gradually build up your capacity to stay with that anxiety, and you increase your tolerance for the various triggers that you have.
Yeah, really good point. And I liked what your patient said there about anxiety. It reminded me, because I remember in our first episode, we talked a little bit about Zen. There's a Buddhist monk called Thich Nhat Hanh. And one of his quotes that I love, he said, "When you learn to suffer, you suffer much less."
Okay.
And I really like that for anxiety, of learning to just allow yourself to feel it. And then eventually you won't feel it as much.
Exactly. No, that's absolutely true. Or, you know, I meet a lot of everyday philosophers in among my patients. And one of them once said, if you have to suffer, suffer with a purpose.
Nice. Yeah. Very Viktor Frankl. Bit,
yeah. So I like that. I tell my patients, I say, you don't have to like it. It's not supposed to be fun or entertainment, but you can learn to accept it.
Yeah.
And acceptance doesn't mean liking. It just means acknowledging that something is real and it exists. That's all.
Absolutely. I think that's a great way of looking at it. So we've got a few listener questions now, specifically for you. So the first one would be, they said, would it be possible for Dr. Penzel to explain what to do as a sufferer if OCD gets in the way of treatment efforts, if it happens while doing ERP?
Ah, that's a great question. And interestingly enough, I wrote an article actually about that, and it's actually posted on my website. It's called both ends against the middle when OCD tries to interfere with its own treatment. And the fact is, it's one of the only disorders that will really do that. It will tell people you can't get better, or you don't know how to do your therapy, you're doing it wrong, you're just going to get worse, or nothing can help you, or you don't really have OCD at all, they're treating you for the wrong thing, or yeah. You're just making this up because you're trying to get out of things, or you're trying to get sympathy from other people. And OCD will really, you know, it has a way of going after whatever matters most to a person.
Yeah.
So in this particular case, if your therapy obviously matters a lot to you and getting well is important, OCD will then go after that. And I think that, you know, that we were talking about expecting the unexpected earlier. And I think that's part of, you know, it's one of the things you should expect. I'm in fact treating somebody right now. Their main symptom is just that OCD tells them that they'll never really understand how to do treatment. They'll never be doing it correctly, and therefore they'll never recover. Yeah. Which ironically is the main part of their OCD, basically. So what we do with things like this is very straightforward. And I think, you know, the basic principles of what you do for OCD are really very simple and very straightforward. I think the idea is that we go toward what we fear. We agree with and accept and stay with the obsessions, and we resist doing the compulsions. Mm. So whatever OCD is telling you negatively about your therapy, the thing to do, of course, is to say, yes, that's true. I don't know how to do therapy. I'm never going to get well. Nothing can help me. I'm just going backwards. Or I only think I'm getting better, but as soon as I believe I'm recovered, I'm going to relapse. Or whatever it throws at you, you sort of throw it right back at it, in a sense. It's like saying, yeah, okay, that's true. But after a while, you realize with OCD, that's the best it can do. That's all it's got. Once you agree with it, it has nothing left,
yeah.
Essentially. All it can do is repeat itself. So this, when OCD attacks your treatment, you handle it the way you would anything else that OCD attacks in your life, and to say, yes, that's going to happen. Yes, it's true. No, there's nothing I can do about it. I'm really, you know, in trouble now. Nothing can help me. And that basically is how you counter it. And at the same time, you don't do anything to make sure that you're doing your treatment perfectly or correctly, because that's what, you know, the compulsions are going to want to make you do. And of course, that's just going to make it worse. I like to tell people that OCD is not a problem of a lack of information. You could have enough information about whatever you're doubtful about to fill a library, basically, and it wouldn't make one bit of difference. So I think you need to understand that getting more and more information about whether you're doing treatment right, or whether your doctor understands you, or whether you understand what you're supposed to be doing, or anything like that, it's useless. It won't help you. So we don't even go there, and we don't even try to do that. We just say, yeah, it's all true. Yes, it's going to happen. Yes, there's nothing I can do.
Yeah. Okay.
So that would be my answer to what you do when OCD goes after your treatment. You just meet it head on, basically, as I was describing.
Yeah, no, really good advice. And so, you know, when your client comes to you and they say, you know, I'm worried that I'm never going to understand treatment, I'm never, et cetera, et cetera, and you can see that this is potentially an OCD worry, how do you respond to that in that moment? Do you kind of say, do you almost force them to do ERP without them knowing it and say, no, absolutely, you're never going to get it? Or do you kind of a bit more compassionately ease them into it?
I will always explain it the first time in terms of just, yeah. You know, putting them wise to what's going on here, okay. What I was trying to do. But once they have that concept, and once they know the situation, I'm certainly not going to reassure them. I'll say, yeah, that's right. You're probably not going to get well. And my patients know, I at the outset of treatment, I always make it very clear that I don't take part in compulsions and I don't do reassurance, because that is guaranteed to make somebody worse. So they know, and once they hear that from me, you know, I sort of get sort of a usually like a knowing smile from the person, and they realize that what they're trying to get from me it's futile. So they'll just say, oh, I get it. Okay, yeah, I'm asking for reassurance. Forget it. You know, and they'll just sort of back off from there. But they know that, you know, that it's in their own best interest. Nobody ever resents that or gets angry at me.
Good. Okay. So next question is, and this is the million-dollar question, which is, I have a hard time knowing what's real and what's not. Can someone with OCD wade through the issue of trusting their own brain, and how do we know when it's OCD?
Okay, how do you know it's OCD? Well, OCD, as we know, many, many years ago, was known as the doubting disease.
Yeah.
So when you have like extreme doubt, you know, and about anything, it could be, as you know, as we said, it could be about any topic, really, and anything's possible when it comes to OCD. When you have that kind of extreme nagging doubt that won't quit, and it just keeps hitting you, you know, in many different forms, and it's just constantly bombarding you with these doubts that won't go away, that no amount of information or no amount of logic or figuring out will deal with, then we know it's OCD. Other ways we know it's OCD is if, you know, the fear itself is very unusual, is not the type of thing that most people would even concern themselves with or worry about.
Yeah.
Or it could be something, you know, it could be like the kind of questions that, you know, in a million years we could never come up with answers to these questions. They're just like rhetorical questions. There's no answer possible that we can give. So these are often the way we know something is OCD. Also, if it has very magical and superstitious quality, in many cases, we know that it's OCD, because OCD does, you know, try to give people all kinds of superstitious fears. And I mean, certain types of OCD do.
Yeah.
And all. So if it involves a lot of magical thinking or things that we know are you know, really in the real world are impossible, but the person worries about them anyway, again, could be another big tip off of OCD. You know, there's a lot of things, there's a lot of pieces you have to put together. It takes a bit of detective work sometimes, although some types of OCD are so straightforward. I mean, you'd have to be literally senseless to miss them.
Yeah.
Well, so OCD is I mean, I guess it's sort of easy for me to say in some ways because I've been treating it for 35 years. But you know, to me, it's unmistakable. I can tell when I'm in the presence of someone with OCD for, you know, using any one of the criteria I just mentioned, basically. But some forms are really very obvious. You know, they're very common. Somebody, you know, is deathly afraid of germs or disease, you know, and is washing and showering constantly. Or they're hoarding great amounts of things, or they're worried about you know, getting magically contaminated or cursed or possessed or things like that. These things usually, you know, they sort of shout OCD at you.
Mm.
So there were some other parts to that question, I think.
Well, I think it just boiled down to how you answered it was basically trusting your own brain and whether knowing it's OCD or not.
Ah, okay. Actually, I would say something a little bit about that, yeah. Because OCD can make people, and I think it's important to understand this, can make you doubt and question the most basic things about yourself. It can make you question your sexual identity. I've had people's OCD actually make them question whether they were alive or not.
Yeah.
I had a woman years ago who would cross the street, and when she got to the other side would think, maybe I've been hit by a car and I'm actually dead, not even really here. Or I've had patients who thought that everything they were experiencing in their everyday lives was unreal because maybe they were lying in a hospital somewhere in a coma and this was all a dream. So OCD can really strike at the heart of the most basic things in your life and make you start to question them. So when it comes to the idea of how do I know what's real, what we don't do in therapy is we don't try to answer that question. We don't try to then, you know, as I said, it's not a problem of a lack of information. So we don't try to give the person all kinds of information to prove that things are real and what they're experiencing actually exists. We do the opposite, actually. Again, we let the thought be there. We stay with it. We agree with it. We say, right, nothing is real. I don't know what's real. I'm never going to know what's real. And, you know, as we work gradually, the person, again, builds up a tolerance for the thought, and then it has no further impact on them. And then they can tolerate, you know, doubts about that particular question without thinking that, oh, I have to do something about this. You know, I have to make it better in some way.
Hmm. Yeah, really, really good answer. Sorry, go on.
It's a very insidious kind of OCD that makes people question things like that.
Yeah. Is it along the lines of, I've heard it called a sort of existential OCD?
Yeah, it would fall into that category. Hmm. Although that's actually a fairly large category too, and takes in a lot of other topics like, you know, like why does the universe exist, or why am I here, or you know, what's the purpose of everything, or how do we know we are even here or not, or, you know, there's all sorts of, or I've had people, in fact, I had a fellow just doing a lot of exposure using the writings of Dr. Stephen Hawking, who sadly just passed away, yeah. But using some of his writings on time and the universe and you know, the meaning of it all and how to take that in, because every time he would read those things, he would start to get really anxious about all these larger questions. Mm-hmm. And so, again, instead of avoiding or trying to answer the questions, we just keep reiterating the questions, and we keep reiterating the doubt and staying with it until, as they say, the person just can't summon up a reaction to it anymore.
Yeah. Always gets bored of it.
Exactly. You know, that's the thing I like to tell my patients, actually. I'm glad you mentioned that. I tell them you can't be bored and scared at the same time.
True. Absolutely. Okay, great. So, so next question is one question, but it's talking about doubt and guilt. And seeing as we just talked about doubt, let's focus on guilt. This person put, would love it if you guys could talk more about guilt. It's a roadblock for me in recovery. How does one move forward with acceptance when the what-ifs OCD offers are a stark contrast to one's personal beliefs and morals?
Well, as we said, OCD can make you doubtful about absolutely anything under the sun, anything that matters to you or anything that's important or that you care about. So, and guilt happens to be a major component in many people's OCD, because the OCD is going to say, well, you're a bad person. In fact, I have a patient right now whose OCD is telling them, you're not a good Christian. You don't know how to be a good Christian. You don't really believe. You're just a Christian in name only, and none of it's genuine. You're just mouthing these beliefs. You don't really believe the things you're saying, and so forth. And it made this person feel very guilty, and as if they'd, you know, sort of like violated all the things they'd been taught growing up and that they'd been trying to live according to in their lives. So, again, in keeping with everything that we've been saying so far, and you know, again, we don't invent a new kind of OCD treatment for every kind of OCD. OCD basically is treated the same regardless of what the topic is. So in cases like this and with this particular person also, what we did was to say, that's right, that's true. We let the thought be there. We said, right, you don't know how to be a good Christian. And we had this person visiting websites, like atheist websites and websites that were critical of people who were bad Christians and, you know, all sorts of things. Anything that would act as a trigger, basically, that we could get this person bored with and build up their tolerance to. You know, again, it's all about tolerance building, increasing capacity to stand whatever OCD can throw at you. I tell people the goal is to make them obsession proof, basically.
Yeah.
So guilt, again, you agree with the guilt, you stay with it, you play it up, you even expose yourself to things that are likely to bring on more thoughts and feelings of guilt. And you keep doing this day after day after day. You keep hammering away at it. It's like you've got a large boulder and you're trying to reduce it to a pile of gravel. Basically, you know, you just keep hitting away at this thing until it falls apart and all. So the guilt is really, it's treated pretty much no differently than any of the other things that OCD hits a person with. And it's attacked in basically the same way. It's just adapted to guilt in this particular case. That's all.
Yeah, no, I really like that. And I like the boulder metaphor analogy. I always get the two mixed up. It's a good way of looking at it. And is it worth saying that, correct me if I'm wrong here, that the emotion, whether it's like anxiety, guilt, shame, doubt, or doubt's not, sorry, they're all kind of redundant, because if we can find the mechanisms that underpin it all and focus on them, the emotions will take care of themselves. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think that, you know, emotions are normal to everyone. We experience them. Unfortunately, people, you know, come to fear their own emotions. Like in panic disorder, people become deathly afraid of experiencing anxiety. But I explain to people, you know, we're capable of all kinds of feelings, hunger, fatigue, anything, you know, pain. Yeah. And you know, we can build up tolerance to all of these things if we don't avoid them. Like people aren't afraid of feelings of hunger. You know, why single out any particular emotion and say, well, that's unacceptable. I should never feel this particular emotion or that particular emotion. We're all wired to feel all these different emotions, just the way everything in the animal kingdom is in one way or another. And so we can't run away from these things. So we have to find ways to allow them to be part of our lives, to accept them, to not fear them or to try to escape or avoid them.
Yeah. Okay. That's interesting. And this is more my own curiosity, and I don't necessarily expect you to have an answer, but interesting to see your point is.
Yeah.
Why do you think, I say we as a society, meaning the UK and America, and I guess any kind of Western part of the world, that we look badly upon anxiety? Do you feel it's something to do with our upbringing or the school system, or that maybe we've never been educated that it's okay to feel things and have emotions, good and bad?
Well, I think part of it, in my estimation anyway, is that people just sort of have this general belief that they should never have to experience discomfort. Mm-hmm. And I think as the world has advanced, there's a lot of kinds of discomfort we have eliminated. People used to suffer greatly with their teeth, for instance, until we had modern dentistry, and they just sort of lived with it, basically. Yeah. They didn't like it. Or people suffered with, you know, all kinds of physical conditions that there are now remedies for that they don't have to suffer with anymore. And people also don't have to suffer, I mean, at least in our societies, from periodic famines or major epidemics. So there's all kinds of things that have been eliminated from our daily lives. So I think, in the modern world, I think a lot of products are sold to people using fear and teaching them that, you know, if you use our product, you can escape and avoid all this discomfort or fear or anything, basically. And it sells, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. I think that's part of it. So I think there are whole industries out there dedicated to telling people that you don't have to be uncomfortable, you don't have to accept these things in your life, and we have the cure, and all you have to do is purchase it, and you'll be all set, essentially. So yeah,
that's a good way of looking at it. And I think what was it, the Maybelline, the makeup company? One of their taglines, and no one quote me on this for fact, but I'm pretty sure I heard their tagline used to be, we don't sell cosmetics, we sell hope. And I think that sums up kind of what you just said about selling on fear, that, you know, aging is bad or having wrinkles is bad or whatever. And,
yeah.
And it's not true.
We're sort of taught that we shouldn't have any problems, that life should be trouble-free and problem-free. And, you know, these are all the various ways to achieve that. And you know, to me, I think the biggest problem is believing that we shouldn't have any problems.
We should just be happy.
You know, and because it renders us unable to cope with these things when they happen, because we simply don't accept them.
Mm. Yeah.
So, you know, and acceptance is a big part of it. We, you know, it's like the serenity prayer that you hear in 12 step.
Yeah.
And all, which is, you know, saying that, you know, we hope to change the things we can change and accept the things we can't change. And I think that's a big part of it. You know, acceptance is a very important skill to master in life. And if we apply it correctly, it can help us deal with an imperfect world where things don't always work out, or where we don't always get what we want, and where we suffer sometimes. And even suffering has to be accepted to a degree, because we can't eliminate these things. They're all part of the makeup of life in general. Boy, we're really getting philosophical here. but it's true. Actually, there's a section in my OCD book where I have a whole chapter on acceptance. I thought it was that important that I devoted a whole section of the book to that, basically. And the idea that the Western idea that we should never have problems, or we should never be uncomfortable. So, and I think it all ties into the problems that people have with OCD and other anxiety problems.
Yeah. I mean, I love getting philosophical, so it's absolutely fine. Whether my listeners like it or not, that's another matter. But, and I guess
I can get dry sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. And maybe we're triggering people with existential OCD or
exposure.
Exactly. yeah, I think it's a good thing. I mean, my background's traditionally is in marketing. I'm now retraining it to be to be a clinician, but. The last sort of 8 years I've been in marketing, and it always didn't sit well with me. I always felt that, and I'd hear myself say things in meetings that didn't align with my values, but it was about selling whatever I was promoting.
Yes.
And that was my job. That's what I was getting paid fairly decent money for. but yeah, sadly, yeah. It's a system where we're set up to fail. Yeah.
Anyway. Well, we just sell people on the idea of being human and being imperfect and living in an imperfect world and still trying to do the best we can in spite of all that.
Well, absolutely. And that hopefully that's what the OCD story stands for now. So I'm righting some wrongs. Okay. Good. So the next listener question is, and this is quite a broad one, but I'll ask it in case there's anything else you want to add to this, which is any tips for handling the chronic nature of the illness would be helpful.
Yes. I mean, of course, the first task is to recover, obviously. And then because it's chronic, you know, I always say that the person most likely to relapse is a person who thought that they were cured. And of course, chronic means just that. You're never cured. But chronic disorders, while they can't be cured, they can be controlled. And the idea is to get your OCD into a good place where it is under control, where you do have your skills up to par, and then you do maintenance, basically, on an ongoing basis, the way you would for any chronic problem, you know, the way you might do exercises or the way you might take a specific medication or follow a specific diet or, you know, anything like that. This is how we deal with chronic problems. We maintain ourselves. We manage them. We keep them under control. And we live, you know, as full a life as we can because of, we do these things.
Mm. Yeah.
So chronic, yeah, a lot of people don't like to hear that it's chronic. I had some fellow post some angry response to me on the internet somewhere about the fact that I said in one of my articles that OCD was chronic, and he did not like that fact. He believed that OCD could be completely eradicated from a person's life, and you know, I take strong issue with that because I know that you know, this is a problem of brain chemistry, and it can't simply be reversed. It can certainly be improved, and you can get it under control to the point where you can live a fully functional and normal life without compulsions or anything like that. Mm. But you know, I like to say that getting well is 50% of the job and staying well is the other 50%. And so once you get recovered, you're only halfway to your goal. Now you have to stay that way for the rest of your life.
Mm. Absolutely. Yeah, I think it's a tough message to hear the first time you hear it. But it's an important one. And the thing I always say is, and a few people said it on the show as well, that you learn so many skills that, yes, you know, you're still having to kind of live with OCD to an extent, but the skills that you learn in recovery apply to so many other areas of your life where people that have never had to learn these skills are getting caught up about trivial things. And those things, what I hear from many OCD sufferers is they say, you know, getting a parking ticket doesn't bother me anymore. It's like, you know, whatever, I can deal with it.
Yeah, it really puts things in perspective.
Yeah.
I think. And I have a lot of people who say that nothing will ever bother them as much again as their OCD did, so that they know whatever they have to face in the future, they'll be equipped to do it and it won't throw them, you know. So it's very important. And you do learn a lot of important skills. I think any learning to face fear and discomfort is always going to be useful throughout your life, because you're always going to run into these things. You know, it's just a part of life, basically. Again, it's one of those things we have to accept.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so I've got a few more questions of my own now. First one, sure, is just a general question. And obviously, any kind of clinician, anyone listening works with, hopefully we'll explain this to them, but for whatever reason, they may not. The question is, when would you introduce imaginal exposure into a hierarchy?
Well, imaginal exposure, let me put it this way. What I try to tell my patients is that the best way to deal with OCD is the most comprehensive way possible. So at any given time, we're hitting it in what we call in vivo, you know, with real life exposures, as well as imaginal exposures. So there's like no special time. We start right from the very beginning, basically. We look for physical triggers in the outer world, and we also use triggers as part of the inner environment as well, because, you know, you find triggers everywhere, basically, wherever you look. So I do a lot of imaginal exposure via recordings. Now that everybody's carrying a phone, it's really quite convenient. and easy to do. So we do recordings. I have people write feared sentences many times. I have them, just agreeing with things is kind of, you know, something that just takes place within your own mind. So we do that. We have people, whenever the thoughts come up, again, agreeing with them, say they like them or the bad thing is going to happen, whatever it is. So we incorporate this all down the line from beginning to end, really. It's not like we bring it in any special way or any special time. Everything we do is sort of a combination of both at all times, really, at least the way I do it.
Yeah. Okay. No, thank you for that. Okay. So what are some of the key things you notice in your kind of most successful clients, successful being either that they get rid of the majority of their OCD or they recover quicker? Is there anything those clients do in specific?
Yeah. You know, it's funny that you should ask that because many people have asked me that question within my own practice. And I tell them that I think the most successful people are the ones who've just sort of totally had it with OCD. I remember someone came in once and said, you know, Dr. Penzel, I don't care what you ask me to do. It doesn't matter anymore. It couldn't be any worse than what I go through on a daily basis. If you tell me to go up to the roof of the building and jump off, I'll do it. Basically, they just, like, all bets are off at that point. Yeah. They don't care. They're prepared for anything because they, you know, nothing could be worse. And they've got it all in perspective, you know, and they just say, I'll do whatever I have to do because, you know, I can't take this and I refuse to live like this anymore. It's like they become indignant in a way, angry at being forced into this in a way. So now they're fully open to anything, basically, whatever it takes. That's their attitude. I'll do whatever it takes. I don't care anymore.
Yeah, that's a really good point. It's kind of. And sometimes people refer to OCD as a bully. And that kind of makes sense of a kid who's being bullied or an adult who's being bullied, because it happens in the workplace too. When they finally get, sometimes those people finally get to a point where they're like, I'm not going to take this anymore. Even if the bully ends up beating me, I'm going to hit them or whatever it is. They stare. And I guess that's kind of what they're doing in that situation.
You know, there was a film years ago, about the media, about a TV news broadcasting, and I forget, but there was a scene where this older broadcaster throws open the window and shouts out, to the world at large, you know, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore, and that's sort of the attitude that you kind of need to adopt in a way, you know. It's just like, that's it. I've reached my limit, and I won't put up with this, and I won't let it do this to my life. So nothing, as I say, it's the idea that nothing could be worse than OCD. It's sort of, you know, like, if strangely enough, some people will come to me and they'll say, I want to get better. I'll do anything. And then I'll say, okay, well, here's what you do. And they say, well, maybe I won't quite do anything. You know, maybe I'm just prepared to do some things. And I know that this is not going to do very well because right from the outset, they're already limiting themselves, you know, and they put a boundary around themselves that they won't cross. And I tell them, I say, if you do that, then you're only going to recover up to a certain point, but you won't get recovered enough to be able to stay recovered. Because that's the other point, is that you have to reach a certain level of recovery to be able to maintain that recovery. Otherwise, it's going to spring back on you, and it's like opening the floodgates, and it all comes rushing back in again.
Yeah. Yeah, really good feedback. Okay, so next question is around tolerance, which you mentioned earlier. So it's, what are some ways people can increase their tolerance of uncertainty?
That is to expose yourself to more uncertainty. Because whatever you stay with, whatever you surround yourself with, you're going to get used to it. Somebody once said, I think it was actually the British intellectual Samuel Johnson, who said that the curse of the human race was that they could get used to almost anything. But actually, he suffered from OCD and Tourette's, by the way.
Oh, wow.
You should check. I have an article about him also on my website.
Cool.
I call him the patron saint of OCD. But anyway, to get back to the question is that, you know, the funny thing is we actually do live surrounded by uncertainty at all times. Life is uncertain. We don't know what's going to happen 5 minutes from now in life. We have no idea. And most things are unexpected. None of us can predict the future. We can guess at it, but none of us know. And it's, you know, life is risky. Life is uncertain. And I think that, you know, again, exposing yourself to that notion will help a person come to terms with the fact that this is a fact of life. This is unalterable, that life isn't knowable, and that we can't change that. And we have no choice but to accept it ultimately. I mean, you can do millions of compulsions, but life still won't be more certain. And all that'll happen is you're now addicted to compulsions and life still is uncertain.
Yeah.
So, you know, but in terms of OCD specifically, again, keep exposing yourself to what your doubts are, you know, that you'll never know, that you can't know, that bad things are going to happen because you can't know the answers to these things and you're going to get in trouble and that it's never going to get any better and so on and so forth. That I think is what you have to do, basically. But it's how you get used to anything, is just staying with it.
Yep. Yeah. Sitting with it.
I hope that answers the question.
Yeah, it did. No, it was very good. Okay, so next one is, how has your view of treating people with OCD changed in the last 10 years? And if so, how? Oh, sorry, has your view, not how has.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I think it's always changing all the time, really, constantly. It sort of sometimes happens to me so subtly that sometimes I don't even notice up to a certain point until it really hits me over the head. I guess I'm trying to think. I always thought that acceptance and a lot of concepts from Zen were very important. Those have become increasingly important to me over the years. I think that has really struck me, that there are just some very important basic truths that are extremely applicable to OCD. That's one way my work has changed. Another is I accept that I can't make everyone want to get better, basically. When I was a younger, newer therapist, I had this idea that I could, you know, treat everybody and get everybody well. And after a while, I found that not everybody was ready, willing, or able to get well at a given time, no matter how much I wanted them to. And so I've learned to accept that. And I'll tell you an interesting little story. It just happened this last week. I had a set of parents came in. They came in without their 16-year-old son who had OCD because he refused to come in. So we talked about it, and I said, well, you know, I don't know much, you know, what we can do for him. I said, maybe I can help you to live with somebody who doesn't want to get treatment. But in the meantime, you know, not much I can do. So the next week, this last week, they brought him back. They brought him in, actually, for the first time. Not that they brought him back, but he came for the first time, and he was extremely kind of flippant and resistant, and he sat there with his eyes closed half the time, and a lot of the questions I asked him, his answer was, I don't know, and I could see, and I said to him at a certain point, I said, I can see you're really not into this. I said, I get the feeling you really don't want to be here, and he said, yes. He said, I don't want to be here. I'm only here because they made me come. So I said to him, okay. I said, you know, I said, you don't have to be here. I said, and I won't take it personally, and you don't have to take part in treatment. You don't have to do any of these things, and you know what? I said, it's okay. I said, I'm not going to sit here and argue with you and tell you that you have to get better or that you must get better or that you have to do anything. I said, because that's not my way. I'm here to help you if you want my help. But otherwise, I'm just going to say, okay, fine, whatever you want to do. If you change your mind, you know, you can come back and see me. I'll be happy to work with you. But I refuse to sit here and try to convince you other than saying, yeah, it's better to be well than not well. And his solution was to, just do whatever it was he wanted to do on his own. He didn't want any part of treatment. So interestingly enough, the next day I got a phone call from his parents. And in the phone call, they said he wants to come back next week. And I thought that was really interesting because I had hoped that that's what would happen. But my way now is I don't try to come on as strongly with people. I say, okay, if you're not ready, if you don't want to do it, I understand, you know, and I understand that I don't have any special powers over you or anyone else. I can't make you do anything. But I find taking that softer approach works a lot better than trying to do a hard sell on somebody, basically, to try to, you know, you can't really convince somebody why they should want to get well if they don't have that concept on their own, basically. Yeah. You can't make somebody want to get better more than they do. So I think that's something that's changed a lot about my work. And by sort of de-emphasizing the fact that anybody has to do anything, I find it works much better, really.
Yeah, no, I agree. So it's kind of like you accepting that you can't necessarily help everyone. In fact, helps you help more people.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. I train doctoral interns from a local university here. And the very first time, they work with me for about a year at a time. And the very first session I ever have with them, I tell them, I say, if you don't learn anything else from me during the next year, I said, I'm going to tell you the most important thing right now. So even if you get nothing else out of this, you'll remember this. I said, you can't help everyone. And I said, that will help you to, A, not get yourself burnt out, and B, not to pressure people too much and to sort of step back and let them decide for themselves. And I think that's more respectful to people that way, too. But you're right. I've gotten further with that in helping people than by telling them that they have to get better or that they have to do anything, because they don't.
Yeah, I agree, and that's good to hear. And I think it probably also comes down to, you know, when I look at stories in my own life and other ones I've been involved in, when someone's not doing well and everyone else, because they care about them, is kind of pressurizing them to, you know, do whatever it is, go to therapy, meditate, I don't know, go for a walk, etc., take medication. And everyone in their life is kind of nagging at them purely because they love that person and want to help them. But it's still coming across as nagging. So when you're in that room and you're the first person that isn't nagging them about it, they're more likely to be receptive to you, I guess.
Absolutely. And as I say, I think it's more respectful, too. I respect their right to choose whether they wish to get better or they don't. And it's really up to them. You know, there's no force or pressure or anything like that. And I don't think therapy should be that way either. It should be purely voluntary because it's something the person themselves wishes to engage in. I mean, even when you're motivated, it's not easy to do. So if you really don't want to do it, you know, the person is not so inclined, you're not going to get anywhere.
Yeah, be a form of torture. Okay, so two more questions now, but these are a bit more I don't want to say lighthearted because I find it all
okay.
But you know, I mean, less OCD focused. So the first one is so if you had to call the 20-year-old Fred Penzel, what would you tell that young man?
Wow. Boy, where to begin? I don't know. I guess what would I say? I tell myself to not take myself so seriously. I think that would be one of the most important things. I don't know. That's a good question. That one actually would require a good bit of thought. But I'd say the most important thing I would tell myself would be to not take myself so seriously, to not think that every moment is crucial and that everything, you know, is for what's the word I'm looking for? That everything isn't life or death, basically. You know, that there's some things in life that matter, but everything doesn't all matter to the same degree.
Yeah, good point. Okay, so the next one is, and I'm not sure, I don't think I asked you this because I don't think I started asking this question until later on in the podcast, but it's basically, what advice do you have? So this is kind of human to human, kind of therapist hat off. What advice do you have to someone who wants to live a good life, whether that's kind of a meaningful life or a awesome life, whatever word we want to use?
Okay. Well, what I like to tell my patients, I say that health overall comes from living in a state of balance. And that means not too much or too little of anything, essentially. And so I think the ancient Greeks came up with that originally, the idea of everything in moderation, basically, and not too much or too little of anything. So this is one thing I try to share with my patients. But the other thing I also tell them, I think if they're going to live a good life, is to not be afraid to take risks or to take chances, because some of the best things that ever happen in your life happen when you are willing to extend yourself and go outside of your comfort zone and do the things that scare you on a fairly regular basis. You know, I think those are important.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's I guess that's the simplest way I could put it.
Yeah. No, really good answer. I like it. Yeah, no, I enjoy that one. So is there anything else that I haven't asked you or that you'd like to share with listeners?
You know, something that's come up with a couple of cases of mine lately that I always thought was a significant point. People would sort of start therapy, or they would be thinking about starting therapy, and they say, well, I don't think I'm ready. This is not the right time yet, and it's not the perfect time. And perfectionism can be a very negative force in OCD, because people think there's like a perfect way to get well, there's a perfect time to get well. And of course, that kind of perfectionism only leads to procrastination. I've had people call me to ask about therapy and then call me 3 years later saying they've thought about it, you know, and so procrastination and that kind of perfectionism is a very negative force. And I always tell people that the best, if you're contemplating getting well, don't put it off. Don't wait for that perfect moment. The perfect moment is any time you're ready to begin, basically. And I think that's a really important point, because so many people say, well, you know, I'm not ready this week or this month, or I have to do this or accomplish that before I'll feel that I'm ready to do therapy. And I say, no, that's wrong thinking. That what you really need to do is just dive right in and get to work on it, because the sooner you do, the sooner you can start living the life that you were meant to live. You can live fully and all. But too many people settle for half lives, essentially, you know, and that's unfortunate and very sad. Yeah. It doesn't have to be that way.
No, absolutely. And there's a saying, is it better the devil you know? Have you ever heard that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. It kind of reminds me of that. You know, it's OCD is a devil, it's a bully, it's scary, but it's familiar.
That's true. Now, people do tend to stick with what they know the best, even if it's not good for them. And we see that in many different ways. But, you know, familiar doesn't necessarily mean better or good. It just means familiar. That's all. I mean, that's how it is. People, that's human nature, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's the risk of the unknown. Less so in modern day times, but I guess evolutionary speaking could have been quite dangerous.
Yeah, but as I say, you know, the risk is an unalterable part of life. It has to be accepted. And the more we accept it, the better we're going to do. In fact, the famous financier, Malcolm Forbes, you know, of Forbes magazine and all that stuff. He had a saying that he said, just getting out of bed in the morning is taking a risk. And I like that. And I think that's really true. You know, I think we just have to just accept that, you know, everything has a certain amount of risk involved in it. But if we were to only think in those terms, we'd never do anything. So,
yeah, no, really good point. Good way to end as well. So thank you again, Fred, for coming on. It was nice to chat with you again for a second time.
My pleasure.
I know the listeners will be eager to hear it. And or I guess by this time they would have heard it. It's always doing it weird in hindsight, because we record these in advance. But then anyway, I'm waffling.
Yeah.
But yeah, hopefully see you at the conference again this year.
Oh, yes. And, you know, if you come up with a new list of questions, I'd be happy to take my best shot at them.
Absolutely. Yeah, we'll do a third round soon.
So there you have it. I hope you enjoyed my chat with Dr. Panzel. And don't forget, if you would like more content than the 4 episodes a month, head over to theocdstories.com/join to become a member. Quick disclaimer, this podcast is not therapy, it's not a replacement for therapy, and nor should it be. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. Till we speak, take care.